It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And, of course, joining us this morning, Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell with Harvell & Collins. And, gentlemen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Lockwood.
Morning.
All right, on tap today, what's our topic?
We want to continue to talk, Lockwood, about the guardianship proceeding, issues concerning guardianship. And today I think we'll move forward a bit into more kind of some of the real intensive kind of litigation aspects of a guardianship. They can evolve, quite frankly, even into cases in the superior court, if you will. But just to back down a bit and give the background for this, a guardianship, Lockwood, can evolve out of any number of factual scenarios. Maybe the current, first of all, that there's no power of attorney. If there's no power of attorney, then we're going to probably need a guardianship proceeding for someone to have the legal authority to handle the affairs of another. The second way that they evolve is many times because the current acting power of attorney is being challenged. Someone is saying that the current acting agent under the power of attorney is violating their fiduciary duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then a third scenario is that notwithstanding that there is a power of attorney, the principal under the power of attorney is saying, no, I don't need a power of attorney. I'm fine. I can take my medicine. I can handle my accounts. I'm going to give $10,000 to five different charities.
Right, yeah.
You can't keep me from doing this. So in other words, there is a power of attorney in effect, but the principal is having a difficult time due to dementia, due to old age, mm-hmm. which is not for the faint-hearted, as we say, having a difficult time letting go, Lockwood. Those are three of the most common factual scenarios that lay the predicate, if you will, for a guardianship. Now, it begins in the Clerk of Superior Court, with the Clerk of Superior Court. It's a hearing that takes place at that level, and there is then usually a decision at that level. And so we will let Mr. Collins take over from here and talk about some of the complications that can evolve even after a hearing with the clerk.
Right. So Cecil's correct that your typical guardianship is going to begin and end at the clerk level, mm-hmm. but there are certain appeal rights to appeal it up to the superior court. Sometimes guardianships can be very straightforward, uncontested. There's no issue with regard to whether the person is incompetent or not. Everyone agrees.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's very well spelled out, even in a power of attorney, indicating who I want my guardian to be. The clerk has to take that into consideration. There's very strong language in our statute about that. Or maybe the family agrees who the guardian should be. So we like to see nice, clean guardianships whenever we have to go that route. But in some cases, they become more contested type guardianships, adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
And as you would guess, Lockwood, in many cases, when it becomes adversarial, money is in the middle of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have guardianships, my goodness, we have many guardianship cases going on at any given time, many adversarial-type guardianship cases going on at any given time, not only in this county or this district, but outside this district. It seems to be more common now than it's ever been. Just these kind of inter-family-type disputes that have to get resolved through the court system, and a lot of times where it starts is a guardianship.
And of course, ostensibly this is a financial issue, but you also have associated with from time to time, do you not, a physical issue, that is the care and the attention associated with these individuals?
No, all guardianships, Lockwood, you're absolutely correct, by definition, concern guardian of the property, guardian of the person.
Mm-hmm.
Both issues are going to need to be addressed. The clerk is not just going to, get all concerned about, if you will, or the parties in the case about the financial well-being of the of our incompetent person, and be not concerned about, well, where are they living? What kind of doctor care do they have? Mm-hmm. Are they in a nursing facility? Are they in a memory care unit? What are the circumstances as to this person's well-being? Mm-hmm. Because after all, if they're not able to take care of themselves, they more than likely are not able to take care of their finances.
No.
If they're not able to take care of their finances, they're more than likely not able to take care of themselves. So both issues are going to need to be addressed. Sometimes it does limit itself to just the property, because everyone is very comfortable with the healthcare agent, if you will, mm-hmm. the person handling the medical end of things. And it does just limit itself to financial, but usually not. If there's a problem, then probably there's a problem on both sides.
All right. Is it possible that there could be a guardianship in a situation where the individual might be competent mentally, but due to physical impairments, not really up to speed and wanting to conduct business, everything from maintaining payments and operations of their home or maybe even their business? Is it reasonable to have you ever had a situation where somebody...
Yes. So I think your question is more along the lines of comparing the cognitive impairment to the
right.
physical impairment.
Right.
And the way the statute reads on that is that if the person lacks the ability to handle his or her affairs through some type of, it could be, you know, an illness, it could even be a physical mm-hmm. impairment. So yes, in certain circumstances, you can have a situation where the court would adjudicate the person incompetent. Now, if it's just a matter of the person, it being difficult for the person,
mm-hmm.
or just being, you know, having, you know, physical impairments that make it more difficult from a logistical standpoint to write the check and those type things,
right.
that would be a much more difficult case. But if we have someone who has significant impairments, maybe they can't use their arms, maybe they have,
right.
you know, these type of issues, then yes, that would certainly lend itself potentially to a guardianship. But at the same time, that, like Cecil indicated, that if we have a power of attorney for those folks at a time, entered at a time when they're able to do that. I mean, for example, let's say that someone just has an issue where they can't use their arms
mm-hmm.
or they can't walk. Well, that doesn't mean that they can't execute a power of attorney, so it might be unnecessary to go through the guardianship process. Understand that executing a properly drafted power of attorney is a much less expensive proposition than
okay.
going through
okay.
a full-blown guardianship. So, and the level of capacity that us attorneys need to see in order for someone to execute a power of attorney doesn't really have anything to do with their physical limitations.
Okay.
Unless maybe they can't communicate that well, but then there's certain things that we can do to make a determination as to whether they have the capacity to contract and to enter a power of attorney.
Okay. You know, you bring up a comment, you use a term here, expensive guardianship.
Right.
What?
Well, it's, you know, it's relative because, you know, when you're talking about a power of attorney, you mm-hmm. know, it may be a, depending on the circumstances, a $75 or $100 document, maybe $150, just depending on what the circumstances are. But then when you're talking about a guardianship, I mean, you have to file a complaint, serve the complaint. A guardian ad litem is appointed. That's a court-appointed attorney for the respondent, the person who we think may be incompetent. We have maybe one hearing, maybe multiple hearings. There could be discovery that's conducted. There could be depositions as part of that discovery. So you see, Lockwood, these multiple steps that I've just gone through, you know, it kind of sounds like a full-blown lawsuit, doesn't
right.
it?
Yeah.
It's more of a, you know, quasi-judicial type situation, maybe a little bit less than your full-blown lawsuit, but still that the amount of time necessary in order to deal with all the issues in a guardianship do in fact dictate much more than $100 of expense as compared to the, you know, power of attorney.
Who, Give me an example of the conflicts that occur in guardianships. Is this between right. two family members or two family units, for example?
They're just all over the place. One I'm dealing with currently, I won't get into, of course, names or much detail about it, but it's about an individual who was in a horrific accident. And, years ago, this person, was adjudicated incompetent after she was in this accident. And after she had multiple surgeries, basically on her brain. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that accident, a large sum of money, was placed in a trust for her as a result of the personal injury lawsuit. So the language of the trust interplays with the guardianship because there were guardians appointed to serve as guardian for this person. But then there's a corporate trustee over the money in the trust. Uh-huh. But the trust also gives the guardians oversight. Mm-hmm. So in that particular type of situation, we're more talking about a restoration of competency. Over the years, she's improved, which is an excellent thing. Mm-hmm. We want that, obviously. But you have to look at whether she's improved to the point where she can handle the funds. Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. whether we still need a guardian or not. So that would be, mm-hmm. without getting any more detail, that would be, you know, a typical type of more adversarial type guardianship proceeding.
Most typical, though, Lockwood, really is that there is an existing agent under a power of attorney,
uh-huh.
and they're operating. But someone else in the family, mm-hmm. or someone closely connected to the individual, to the principal, to the person who is having their affairs taken care of by another,
mm-hmm.
someone close to that person, be it a family member or be it someone connected with them, thinks that the agent under the power of attorney is abusing their power, that their loved one is not in the right facility,
right.
that the bills are not being properly paid,
mm-hmm.
that they are overcompensating themselves,
mm-hmm.
that they are using the principal's financial well-being to their well-being. They're commingling, if mm-hmm. you will. They're violating the fiduciary duty. This is the most typical factual scenario that we hear probably in our office, a challenge by another to the existing agent under the power of attorney. And I would say second to that and quite common, I'd say here maybe about a 60-40 split, Wes probably would have his opinion too, of course, is the issue of, you know, well, my dad, we have this power of attorney, but my dad just will not let us use it. I mean, I have a file right now where they are, no one wants to light the match, if you will,
okay.
to adjudicate their father or mother incompetent. But if their father is, you know, buying an enormous amount of, you know, things on Amazon, doesn't even realize what they're doing, won't take the medication, is ornery, stubborn, belligerent.
Influence from others.
Wait, say that again. I had the microphone.
Maybe subject to undue influence. Could be a caregiver is too much involved, and maybe we're concerned right. about going on there, those type things.
We'll take a quick break. I want to get back to that, right. Talk about that from the perspective of the families. You're listening to Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins here this morning. And by the way, I didn't even mention, if you wish, you can call in if you've got a question, because this is one of those topics that, you know, I think, sadly, gentlemen, we're probably going to see more of, not less of. The numbers here, of course, 910 area code 353-4674, 252 area code 247-7282, and, of course, the 800 number 818-2255. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And just very quickly to remind you, the number for them directly, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050 mm-hmm. at 1107 Bridges Street in Warren City, or mm-hmm. go online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, Harvell, H-A-R-V-E-L-L, by the way, harvellandcollins.com. Back to my question as we were going into this conversation, and of course, it's having to do with the whole issue of guardianship, and I'm very impressed by the comments you've made a few moments ago about the expense. But in those instances where you're attempting to establish the need for guardianship, and that is ostensibly, I'll just go ahead and describe it this way, an issue of competency. That's got to be a challenge. You mentioned a few moments ago, Wes, the description, a guardian ad litem.
Mm-hmm.
What is the purpose of the guardian ad litem? What are we talking about here? And is that used in these instances where the children, for example, just use this as an example now, the children are trying to tell the court their parent is right. having some difficulties. Is this where the guardian ad litem steps in?
Partially. So obviously, when we're in a guardianship proceeding, we have someone who maybe can't handle their own affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So the law recognizes that fact and makes sure through the guardian ad litem appointment that they have their own advocate.
Okay.
And that's what that's about. That's an independent, neutral, selected by the clerk, who is the guardian ad litem, to watch out for the affairs of the respondent. Now, that's a sticky wicket. Let me explain why. The guardian ad litem's job is not to do what the respondent wants.
Right.
The respondent could say, I'm fine. I don't want a guardian.
Right.
Now, the typical attorney, me representing my client, I better do what my client wants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when we're talking about a guardian ad litem, the guardian ad litem is supposed to watch after the best interest of the respondent. And even if the respondent, the person we think is incompetent. Even if that person thinks I'm doing fine, I don't know why they're putting me through this, I don't need mm-hmm. a guardian, those kind of things. If the ultimate opinion of the guardian ad litem is no, you're not doing fine and you are being subjected in undue influence and you can't handle your affairs and so on and so forth, then the guardian ad litem would report to the court that in their opinion that this person does need a guardian. So you're supposed to do what's in the best interest of the respondent as guardian ad litem, but that's not always what the guardian ad litem wants. So that's an interesting situation. So the guardian ad litem will interview the respondent and interview the petitioners, the people who are asking for the adjudication of incompetence. We'll do some investigation and we'll file a report with the court. And that's not always the end of the story, though, because a lot of times you'll have also a multidisciplinary evaluation where the clerk of court is appointing like a clinical psychologist or maybe a neuropsychologist
mm-hmm.
to do an evaluation cognitively to make a determination really more from a medical standpoint in most cases as to whether the person is able to handle their affairs.
So the guardian ad litem, Lockwood, as Wes is saying, is an independent advocate, usually a lawyer, appointed by the clerk of court. We have some really great ones here in Carteret County, two or three, that usually kind of handle that. Well, volunteer, if you will, mm-hmm. to be a guardian ad litem, and the clerk understands their work product and feels confident in them. And so they would make a home visit, maybe more than one. They would go to the nursing home or the memory care unit, wherever the principal might be. They will review carefully the pleadings in the case, because suppose that this is one of these cases where someone is alleging that there's malfeasance of the principal's assets, that they've taken $10,000 out of the account for themselves. So the guardian ad litem is going to need to review what all of the allegations and responses are, if you will, in the pleadings of the case, and attempt to investigate that as best as he or she can. And then, as Wes is mentioning, they then render a report. They will testify, and they will speak their piece independently as to what their discovery and their opinion happens to be.
Is it possible? We got to go to another break. Is it possible then for one of the, I'll use the word, one of the two parties, the petitioner or respondent,
right?
Then could in fact challenge the decision of the or the option of the report of the guardian ad litem?
Yes,
happens
absolutely.
Quite frequently.
Whoa,
yes.
I can see this breaking up into a situation where you almost triangulate. You've got two groups of family members attempting to identify a parent or a family member as being incompetent, and the two of them are fighting. I can see a triangulation here. Does that happen very often?
Yes.
It does.
Whoa. We're talking with Wes Collins and
Bermuda Triangle.
I mean, Lockwood, just real quickly, this is litigation.
Understood.
This is why we're here in this place.
We're wrapping things up with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and we're talking about the issue of guardianship. And I'm looking for kind of a question here or an answer. Is there a simple way out, or is this, unfortunately, you said a moment ago, this is litigation.
This is litigation. And so with litigation, Lockwood, comes always the possibility of a settlement. I mean, yes, there can be a resolution. Go ahead, Wes.
I think one thing that has to be said is that in many cases, we can avoid guardianship if the family would just simply be transparent. For example, let's say that we've got second marriage.
Let me interrupt
you. Go ahead.
Let me interrupt here. We were talking off air.
Sure.
There are situations, you were saying, where when it's all said and done, the total cost, legal cost, is going to be
six figures,
$100,000 or more.
Well, those are rare cases.
But it still could be. But even five figures.
Could be. Those are rare cases.
Okay.
Could be very expensive if it's like the trust case I was talking about. There's a lot at stake in that case.
But my point is this, that how do you, even if it's four figures, is there a way to avoid this?
Well, first of all, transparency. I mean, let's say that we have the second or third husband or wife or whatever in the family, and we think that they're misusing the money of our mother or our father or whatever. Just ask for the documentation. Show me the bank records. Show me how things. And if the husband or wife will not show those, we're off to guardianship.
Okay.
Because through the guardianship, the clerk should allow you to get that information, if this person wants to be guardian, because they can't hoard away the assets and be guardian as well.
Gotcha.
They can't guard the hen house.
Okay. All right. We're wrapping it up with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and I'm kind of fascinated by this conversation.
So, yes, I mean, we've been in highly contested hearings, if you will, where the parties finally agree, the brothers against the sister.
Right.
And so they finally agree, okay, fine. Neither one of us will do it. We will let the public guardian handle the affairs. Or the clerk of court, encourages, encourages that resolution maybe in chambers take place between the lawyers and between their clients. So there is the ability here for there to be a settlement. Lockwood, just like in any civil litigation case. Yes, sir.
All right. That's Harvell and Collins with us this morning. I was about to say this afternoon. Local number 726-9050. I think it's an important story. 726-9040 or go online at harvellandcollins.com. Let's talk legal.